Okay. Recording has started. Hi, Joan. Well, who has a joke while we're waiting?
Just remember, the joke is going to be recorded.
Mm-hmm. And that's funny in and of itself.
Mimi, where do you teach, Mimi?
What are you asking me?
Yeah, well, where do you teach?
I'm still a student.
Oh, you're still a student. Okay.
I study international policy.
Where?
Stanford.
Oh, okay. Not far from me then. I teach at the University of San Francisco. I live in Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not far at all.
Are you still teaching by Zoom, Stephen?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll be back on campus in August, but... Yes, as Betsy Ripe pointed out, it's like teaching online is like twice the work satisfaction.
Oh, and the shorter commute doesn't help.
You'll have a long commute, so it's nice not having that, but I just really miss the personal interactions with students, especially since I tend to pace when I lecture and I'm, you know, doing all this kind of stuff and sitting in front of a computer is just really crimps my style.
I hear you. Just head and shoulders is not pacing on stage. It's just not. Okay. Let's see. I sent out an agenda to the Weavers Committee. I'm wondering if someone would like to keep time for us. I'm thinking Mary or Joan, and I can send the agenda to other people if there's someone else that is interested in volunteering.
I think Mary knows how to have both documents or both things up at the same time, and I don't. I would have to print it out, and I didn't do that. I just saw it.
No problem then.
So Joan, you don't want to keep time because you don't have the times?
I don't have it printed out. I would have to have it printed out.
Okay. Yeah. So who's going to be the chat watcher if I'm going to keep time?
We might not need a chat watcher. Okay, I'll try to do it. I'll check it out.
I'll be away for like 1 minute. I'd rather have my watch. I'll be back in 1 minute.
Okay, Herb's mic check. Can you hear me?
I hear you. Hear you, Herb.
Yes.
You're kind of staticky, but I hear you.
It sounds terrible, but we hear you.
And we are recording. So if you don't want to be seen, you can click your little slider closed.
Oh, Nancy, think.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then Lee, you made it.
I made it this time.
Okay.
It's pouring down rain in Philadelphia. A lot of wind.
Yeah, just suddenly now. A few minutes ago. How is it out in California?
It's lovely.
Is it raining in Washington, Herb?
No. But it's been 87 for 2 days, and our HVAC broke last night. So I'm hassling with that. And let me just quick say while I'm on the mic in 30 seconds, my website, I'm not sure about my email so much, but the website was hacked. I think I just wasn't careful enough with the passwords, but I'm covering all the security breaches and so on. But basically I had to, fortunately I had good backups of all the individual pages on the sites, but long story short, I'm still in the process of loading those up. So there will be a public M&S site for the public to see come Saturday, May Day, and I will send an email to that effect. And if Seth or whoever sends me the video from tonight, I'll include that and also in the message to M&S Hall. I want to say one quick thing about M&S Hall. As Fred knows, not only do we need to, you know, contain or, you know, limit the number of messages that go out there, usually that's not a problem, but we've got a little more of a flurry now with various reasons, including these Zooms. We need to be careful and at most send two messages about anything, but only two if there's a really good reason to send the second. But also to keep them shorter and tighter, because longer messages can also do that. We had two people unsubscribe this week who, you know, I was trying to get them involved, but so we're going to lose some more folks that way, but we'll be able to retain more if we limit the messages and also keep them brief like I try to be.
So I only sent two, one like 10 days ago and one 2 days ago.
Yeah, those were good guidelines, Herb. That's helpful.
Yes, thank you, Herb. Well, we are coming up to like 3.5 minutes left in the welcoming and saying hi and getting reacquainted. Do David or Nancy want to say anything?
Hi, it's Dave Loeb. Outside of Philadelphia. I did a small but significant nonviolent intervention on my own early this morning with one of my neighbors here in an apartment building I live in. So I hope things work out. Maybe learned a little bit. I know I've learned a little bit too. So. Some violence got, I think, interrupted. Small thing I've never tried before. I could really use a workshop one.
Yeah, hi, this is Nancy Fink, now in Oberlin, Ohio. And David and I are fine, working mostly on issues having to do with undocumented immigrants here in our area. We have lots of Mexican immigrants and others from Central America in the town just a couple miles north of us, Lorain, Ohio. And we're working with an organization there. And otherwise, well, and with the Quaker meeting, I don't know if you all are in touch with Quakers, but FGC's Friends of Color issued an epistle last summer at the gathering with some queries for Quakers, such as how can Quakers create space for Friends of Color, etc. And so our meeting is trying to work on those questions which of course bring us generally to racism. That's it. I'm glad for this tonight. Thanks everybody for coming and doing.
Six. Mary's waving.
Yeah. Okay. Nobody's going to recognize me, but I'm unmuted, so I'll speak.
Yeah.
You could have said Mary, but you didn't.
Anyway, not facilitating. I'm not the facilitator.
Well, nobody did. Okay. My news is that my right knee, that has been a problem since 1993, graduated into a stage of problems that I've never had with it before, where it does this thing like if I'm standing, like trying to prepare some food for myself or something, it like gets frozen and I can't go forward. I can't go back. I can't put all my weight on that knee because it's really painful and so on. But the good news part of it is, number one, in a couple more weeks, I will be getting injections of a new wonder drug in my knees. Number two is I have discovered that if I mainly stay sitting down or laying down and walking a little bit, if I need to stand somewhere and I pay attention to how long I'm standing and I pick that leg up and move it like back and forth or make believe marching or something, it doesn't seem to freeze, for which I am very grateful. I have not been out of my house like in a week since this whole business began, and I'm getting more stir crazy than COVID ever got me, because with that I could always decide, well, I'm going out, I don't care. But with the fact that I'm afraid that, you know, if my knee froze or I fell down or something and I went out alone, I would be up a tree, let's say, to be polite. Anyway, that's what I had to say. Finished.
Okay, I think we're up to agenda review. I've posted the agenda in the chat. The next thing is for me to introduce Michael, and then if Michael has his slideshow ready, to do a slideshow about the Civil Resistance Book and Nonviolent Tactics Database. Then brief Q&A about that, brief introduction from Michael about the situation in Burma, including nonviolent involvement from MNS and fellow travelers like Michael. And then shifting over to Mimi Kant for more on Burma, the history and current situation and what we can do. I should say that both of these fine folks exist and are able to do their work with donations. And so I posted in the invitation email links to donate to Nonviolence International. I don't have a link for Mimi for where people can donate to you. Maybe you could put something in the chat. Does anyone have other things that they would like to add other than the usual general discussion, evaluation, closing, etc.? Okay, sounds like we're good to go with that.
And our time is good.
All right. So Michael has been on and off my radar for a couple of decades, and this is the first, this occasion is the first time I've gotten to work directly with him. He's director of Nonviolence International based in DC. And works with people's movements all around the world, helping to advise on nonviolent tactics and strategy, and has helped overthrow a few dictators and has a few more in the pot. I thought it was particularly useful to have him and Mimi Kant on today because he had been involved early on in consulting with the freedom movement in Burma. So you can add more if you want, Michael. You can unmute yourself. Okay. So I'm not hearing you, Michael.
There I am.
There we go.
Hey.
Okay. Take it.
Thank you, Fred, for taking a lot of time to set this up, and Joanne, and Seth. It's great to have you all here today. And I know many of you are quite knowledgeable about nonviolent action, and some of you know quite a few things about Burma. It's wonderful to be on with you, and I'm so glad you're taking your time to be with us tonight. And I'm eager to hear what Mimi has to say in terms of an update on Burma. I first got involved with Burma, and I'll say this for you folks, because you know, I first got involved with Burma in 1990, in May of 1990, when George Lakey asked me to join him as a co-trainer to go to the Burma border of Thailand, where an ethnic group, the Karen, had control, and to teach at their federal university. This was all set up by Suluk Sivaraksa, the famous Thai Buddhist activist. And so that's where I got my, began. We did 3 weeks together, George and I, in the jungle during the rainy season. And it was actually happened to be May 1990 when there was a dramatic election in Burma that was stunning, and the opposition won a completely overwhelming victory, and the military was completely shocked and horrified, and then just refused to honor those elections. I remember the evening in this capital of this opposition and guerrilla held territory, George and I were the only outsiders, and we were asked to speak in front of a huge hall, and everybody was in shock about the results. And we pleaded with them. We said, please, the military for 3 to 5 days is going to be in complete shock. This is not a trick. Seize power right now. Don't wait for the military to regain its balance. Seize power immediately, declare victory. And unfortunately, we were out in Manipal and they couldn't hear us in Rangoon.
Oh.
But I still so vividly remember us pleading with them that this wasn't a trick and there was a huge opportunity and it was missed. And 30 years later, they're still under military rule. Mm. In any case, I'm really supposed to be talking about my book now. So I'll do a quick run through of the book. Basically, I've been trying to ask people for decades, would somebody please update Gene Sharpe's 198 methods? You know, 1973, people are still talking about 198 methods, you know, 45 years later, 48 years later, and nobody did it. So finally I did it. It took me a few years, it was hard. I realized between you and me that Gene Sharpe's methods are not as clearly defined in social science as many of us thought they were, and that there's all kinds of inconsistencies, and which is fine. I mean, that's the human condition, and nonviolent struggle is so diverse. So I've learned a lot. What I've basically done is tried to build on Gene Sharpe rather than try to reinvent something new, despite the fact that some of his foundations are not as solid, particularly on the definitions of what a method is and what it isn't. I at Nonviolence International, with our interns mostly, we started gathering tactics and and methods. And why focus on tactics of the database and book to document the universe of nonviolent action tactics, which is now at 360 plus, to update a framework if there was any updating, and I did update a framework for categorizing them, and to help us advance understanding in the field. I'm not going to talk to you about what is a nonviolent tactic or method. I think we could have a long discussion about this, but I've basically tried to follow on what Gene Sharp did, even if it's pretty shaky in reality about what exactly is a tactic or a method. Definition of civil resistance. Again, this is extra institutional action. You all know this. Basically, conflict that's waged out of the courts, outside of elections, outside of legislation. And it pretty much encompasses everything else. It's a grab bag of everything that's not institutionalized conflict resolution. I like to look at civil resistance at three levels: the action level or tactic method level, the campaign level, and the movement level. And I think particularly as teachers and trainers, it's important to know which training level you're at. I spent a lot of time with George Lakey and then with Bob Helvey in the jungles of Burma, teaching a lot about movement, vision, grand strategy. And a lot of those people in the jungle were not equipped to handle that kind of training because they didn't have the resources or the people power to mobilize to actually make use of a lot of that big picture skill level. And we should have been teaching much more at the action level and campaign level rather than at the grand movement level. And it was actually disempowering a little bit. So you really want to focus on the right level of training and teaching for the group that you're working with. How do nonviolent tactics function? This is something that Gene Sharp didn't really go into much. Doug Bond has done the most work on this. And I took some of his work and I tweaked it a little bit. But basically, he has three mechanisms. This is not to be confused with the mechanisms of change, which George Lakey and Sharp came up with, which is how the opponent responds to pressure. But this is actually the functional, the mechanisms by which nonviolent action and tactics work. And one is manipulation of resources or controlling resources, which is saying, doing, and not doing. It's an enormous universe of action. And then basically you can use threats and impose costs, or you can, on the constructive side, you can do appeals, rewards, and competitive modeling. Competitive modeling means setting up a competing, let's say, drug clinic that they did during the AIDS epidemic, set up a competing HIV clinic because the government wasn't delivering the service. And in Washington, D.C., that became the Whitman-Walker Clinic, and because it outcompeted the rest of the health system, and everybody went there for their pharmaceutical needs and healthcare needs. So the whole idea is that in many respects, nonviolent tactics can sometimes be one in which you set up parallel government or parallel institutions. So those are the three major tactics and mechanisms. And you can see I build on Gene Sharp's a little bit. He had the three layers. I make them more easy to understand in layperson's language. He talked about protest and appeal. I talked about saying, or he said, talked about protest and persuasion. I talked about saying, not doing, which is what he called non-cooperation, and doing and creating on the, down the side there. That's controlling resources along the side. I'm really flying. I'm sorry I'm going so fast, but I don't know if it's making a lot of sense. But I have 15 minutes. I'm just trying to make it go quick. As you can see, I took Gene Sharp's categories and basically I put it into positive and negative, or confrontational or constructive, and have kind of lined up his tactics into those various categories. What emerged new that had never emerged before was the tactic called refraining. Sometimes I might even call this tactic cooperation. It's not used very often, but there are examples of this where you halt or call off a planned or ongoing action to reward or persuade. The most best example of this is suspending a strike, particularly like a strike of a transit strike, where they might call a strike and then very soon thereafter suspend the strike unilaterally, not to piss off the public and to open up negotiations again with the authorities. And so Gandhi did this way back in the 1890s when he called off a proposed train strike for other reasons. So this refraining category is interesting, and nobody's really has articulated this before. And we need a PhD thesis on refraining types of nonviolent action. Basically, it's the same thing I'm talking about, keeping Gene Sharp's categories, just tweaking them a little bit. I don't use the word persuasion, I use the word appeal. Persuasion implies that maybe it succeeded. And if it doesn't succeed, then is it really a tactic or an action? So I use the word appeal instead of persuasion, but basically keeping his same categories. I'm flying, I'm sorry, folks. Why update Gene Sharp's work now? As you can see, there's been a lot of change in the 48 years. You people are all old, you've seen it all. The spread of digital technology. Gene Sharp did not, document very well arts and cultural resistance. So there's a huge set of stuff that he'd never really got much of. The spread of human rights activism has had a really big impact. And there's a whole website called New Tactics in Human Rights, which is really great, which has similar tactics of nonviolent tactics to what we have, but also some in the legal institutional sphere. The spread of civil resistance knowledge and ideas has had a profound impact. We now have nonviolent resistance going on all over the world. So tremendous innovation just through widespread knowledge. Women and sexual gender minorities have always done nonviolent struggle, but have emerged even more strongly with lots of innovation and leadership. And then globalization and governance issues. We have multinationals that have emerged very powerful in the world, and governments can't seem to hold them back. So we have WTO and anti-corporate multinational corporation campaigns that have been going on against corporations in innovative ways that we haven't had before. And media influence on public perception. I don't even remember what that one is. So I've made up some subcategories, protest and appeal. We've done subcategories there, the human body, material arts, communication through digital technology, communication through human language. So the top row is all communication, and they're the four dimensions of communication. And we feel like that's a much better set of subcategories than what Sharp had. Otherwise, we used his other subcategories mostly. For refraining, I only have two kinds of tactics under that I can even come up with for refraining. It's not a very big category. I'm flying. What are some new ones? Flash mob. You guys know what a flash mob is. This is from Malaysia. And this is their Occupy movement in Malaysia, calling for freedom. Growing body hair, cutting body hair, doing all kinds of stuff with body hair is interesting. Casserole. This is what people in Burma have done a lot of. Banging on pots and pans. This started in 1971 by Chilean women, to the best of my knowledge, and it's now spread all over the world. It's been a real key in a lot of anti-corruption protests around the world. Digital games. Hong Kong has done a lot of these. creative ways to criticize the regime and to get people to practice mobilizing against a regime. Murals, this isn't exactly new, but again, Gene Sharp didn't have a big, you know, big emphasis on the arts and the artistic stuff. And certainly murals are fabulous all over the world. And this one's in San Francisco. I don't know if any of you know where this one is. Anybody know where that is?
No.
It's a good one. I don't know. Maybe it's not there anymore. And sous-valence, I love this one. Sous-valence is the French word sous means under, surveillance from below. And this is what the people do towards the police and the authorities. A great example recently is what the people did documenting the murder of George Floyd. And so the governments, like the Burmese government, like the US government, whatnot, they surveil the citizens, but citizens with our cell phones and our technologies, we surveil the them. Mic check, that became popular during Occupy. Kind of a human microphone, but it's also a performance piece. Withholding religious rights, this one comes from Burma. This was done in 1990, it was done in 2007, and then recently again. And you know, the Burmese Buddhists have done this. Historically, the Pope and Catholic priests have done this, and other kinds of religious leaders. Divestment really started, as many of you know, and were active. Many of you were active in the anti-apartheid movement and were leaders. And that was really the first big divestment movement that I'm aware of. And it's hard to get a picture of divestment. So here's a picture of a big people, a big set of people holding up a picture of divest. And the most common problem with divestment is that people don't understand the difference between divestment and disinvestment. But in any case, this is a climate change divestment thing from fossil fuels and is a very powerful economic tactic. And suspension. Here's a teacher suspension in Arizona where they suspended a strike. And a die-in, even though that goes way back, Sharp hadn't documented this. And so here's a die-in on around Palestine. This is very common, and there's often blood or various kinds of things. Self-mutilation, some people wouldn't call this nonviolence, but it's used in a lot of nonviolent movements. There are various kinds of things. You can branding, I've seen tattoos. In this case, people sewing their lips shut at refugee camps. Some people wouldn't call this nonviolence, but it certainly isn't violence against others. It is, in some cases, be considered violence against self. But there are some gray areas that we talk about in our work. In our documentation here. Critical mass bike rides. I think many of you know what these are. These are mass bicycle rides. And this is competitive modeling to some degree. This is where we just want to take over the roads with bicycles and get rid of cars altogether. And so it's not just a question of a protest. It's also modeling the kind of future that we want. Takeaways. Nonviolence doesn't happen without tactics and training. Nonviolence is still in its infancy. And I also have a website, tactics database website that I really should very, very briefly show you. We've documented 360 methods and have some new categories. And I think the most interesting thing is I did come up with these mechanisms of direct action, the three mechanisms of controlling resources, kind of coercion and persuasion. Let me just finally go quickly to my tactics website. This is the new tech. We hope that you'll all help us build this website. You can look at different categories and see different examples of tactics. I have a big list view. If you want to see a list view of all the categories and all the tactics, you can click on any of these and get where you want. In other words, we display these tactics in lots of really different cool ways. You can look at all the acts of expression, and you want to look at all the protests and appeals. You want to look at all the medium of the human person, medium of human language. You can see medium of things. And as you can see, we have all these different tactics with photographs and examples. You can click on any one of them, click on wearing symbols, and we'll have a photograph of it. And then below we have an example, Des Moines students protest the Vietnam War. And if you want to see the original article, you can click on the original article and go read the original example. I give Gene Sharp's ID number because a lot of people still like Gene Sharp for his things. And so I have his tactical ID number for people that want it. So I'm sorry, I really went fast. And that wasn't actually my best slideshow. I have another one that I should have shown instead of this one. This was a little outdated.
But you finished on time, Michael.
The book's 110 pages long. It's free. And sorry to go over my time.
You didn't. You're right on time.
Right. And the links to the book and the tactics database are in the invitation email.
So it was a terrible presentation. I just flew through everything. Sorry. But
it gave us a good overview.
Yeah.
Great material.
And we'll welcome you back to see your updated slideshow, maybe in a year or so.
Very impressive.
Well, what I'd love for you to do is, as I'd love for you all to find examples of tactics or new tactics, and on our website, there's a Google form, you fill it out, just give us the information and we can get it up there. We need lots of photographs that are Creative Commons or that we can use. It's a real challenge to find photographs for a lot of these tactics.
Great. Okay. So let's see. Here we go. Mimi Kant, whoops, object not found. Okay, well, Mimi Kant is a primary activist, one of the key people in organizing the Free Burma movement, and has been involved for quite a while, and is currently, I think, doing a doctorate in international relations. Is that correct, Mimi?
I'm doing a master's.
A master's, okay. Anyway, is there anything else that you'd like to say by way of introducing yourself?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for inviting me here to speak today. I am an activist and I'm a former student union leader from Myanmar. So I was born and raised in Yangon, lived there for about 20 years of my life, and then moved to the US to do my undergrad here in the US. And now I'm at Stanford studying international policy as a master degree. And I'm also a Nye Hennessy scholar here at Stanford. I've been involved as a student union leader. I organized a lot even before things were opened up in Myanmar. So I had that connection after the coup happened. A lot of my friends are still organizing on the ground in the country. And I'm also a poet. So I've written about freedom of speech, especially in the country, and a lot of political poems starting, I think, around 2013. So I've been written since then, and I have also published a couple of collections. So that's kind of where my background is and how I'm sort of relevant to the movement. Since after the coup, I've been organizing here in the US and also helping with a lot of activists from on the ground in Myanmar and also around the region. So I've been in contact, especially with, if you have been following Myanmar, you probably heard of the term Milk Tea Alliance. So this is a organic alliance between activists from Myanmar, Thailand, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and then beyond other countries like Philippines, Malaysia, sort of regional alliance. And I've been involved a lot with activists from the region. I've organized in I've been organizing based in the Bay Area. I was just visiting even in New York and DC, and then joining the rallies as well. So I've been quite involved a lot in the US and organizing that. We've done some advocacy work on the front as well, but I'm mainly involved with organizing, and I've just now gotten into advocacy and just started ramping up on that front. So that's sort of my background. I don't know how much background you have in Myanmar, so I would just sort of give a brief intro and guideline, and then just sort of update you on what is currently happening and what is most important right now and what you can do in terms of helping the movement and helping the people who are on the ground. So as we all know, currently there's a crisis in Myanmar, and now at the shortest term, we can link it back to February 1 coup by the Myanmar military. So military staged a coup and overthrew a democratically elected government on February 1 and then thrown the country into this current uprising and current democratic movement that we see today. But the struggle doesn't start there. The struggle dates back all the way to 1962 and however you define it. And in fact, the political struggles go back all the way into 1948 when the country emerged out of colonialism and then start gaining its independence. So 1948, Myanmar gains independence, Obama gains independence from the British. And then just right before the independence, all the ethnic groups in the country sign what is called the Panlong Agreement, just agreeing a political sharing of power between different ethnic groups in Myanmar right after the independence. So it was political arrangement was set in that a year before the independence. But then what happened was all the political leaders that signed the agreement got assassinated the same year. So even though after we had the independence, the agreement wasn't honored. And a lot of the ethnic groups went into fighting it because of the political, they weren't satisfied with post-independence political arrangement. So in that sense, the ethnic strife and the political struggle started right after the independence which is still related to a huge background of the democratic movement and the current struggle in the country. And so right between 48 and then the military's first stage of coup in 1962, there were a brief period of time, the country was prosper a little bit, but at the time the military take over the power and take over the country, there were already political instability. And then the military staged a coup in 1962 and what it started a long period of military dictatorship in the country. So the first time the military staged a coup, 1962, and then the military wanted to change it into a socialist country. They call it, the dictator then called it the Burmese way to socialism. It substantially changed the constitution. And then in 82, it defines the citizenship law, which basically codify the discrimination of a lot of the ethnic groups in the country, which caused a lot of problems like the Rohingya crisis later on. And so that sort of set into a lot of the problems then. So within that period of time, there were a lot of revolutions and a lot of democratic movement and people uprisings in the country, and each and every one of them were met with brutal crackdown by the Myanmar military. So Myanmar military crackdowns and the cruelty that we are seeing today isn't something that is new to a lot of us and a lot of the Burmese people who lives in the country. So for instance, my grandfather was a rebel group leader, and he half of my mom's life he is in prison for the political rebellion that he was taken on. And my mother was a student leader in 1988 revolution. And again, her generation was also faced with a similar brutal crackdown that we're seeing today. And if you know, a lot of the leaders who are in the country, in the United States, for example, fled the country from 1988. There was another revolution again in 2007, the Saffron Revolution, which Michael, in Michael's photo, there was a picture of the monks, which is probably from the 2007 revolution as well. And so that's the revolution that I remember. I was 11 years old when the Saffron Revolution happened. I actually was in the city when the military started gunning down the protesters. So that's something that we witnessed as family. And that's the sort of a similar experience for a lot of the Burmese people. So it's not just something that is going on now, it's something that dates back to generation. It's a generation of struggle and generation of trauma that that people has been going through. But after several revolution and several uprising in 2010, the military suddenly changed their mind and say, okay, we'll turn ourselves into a civilian government. And 2 years earlier in 2008, they came out and say, this is gonna be the new constitution. They released out this 2008 constitution and say that this is gonna be a political arrangement going forward. And this is going to transform us into what they call a disciplined democracy. In the constitution, what they mean by disciplined democracy is essentially a democracy, an authoritarianism behind the facade of a democracy, and what is basically what it was for the last 5 years between 2015 and 2020. So when they switched themselves into a civilian government, according to that constitution in 2010, they frauded the election. They said that they won. They won the election and they took over, and that the general turned themselves into civilian and they took over the government and say, we now have a civilian government with a military state, substantial amount of military control in politics. So the military state control 25% of the parliament seat in the parliament, and state took a huge number of really important ministry in the country. So the government couldn't do anything without the military's approval. The military can do whatever they want essentially and can influence a lot of the politics in the country. But one thing that changed in that period of time is they released Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the icon of pro-democracy movement, and how she founded that. She came out as a leader in 1988 revolution, which is the most important pro-democracy revolution. And she founded the democracy, her National League for Democracy party. But after the revolution, she was largely under house arrest for about 20 years, starting 1992 until they opened back up again in 2010. And then when they transitioned, she was released. But at first she boycotted the 2010 elections, but she entered into politics with 2012 by-election. So she, so that was something that the fact that she's going to be able to be in the parliament was something that nobody expected would happen. But after she was able to come into the parliament, and then her party competed in the elections in 2015 and they won the landslide elections. At the time, people were unsure whether they would actually be able to form a government, but essentially the military let them form the government, and the Aung San Suu Kyi and her party came to power between 2015 and 2020. But then after the 5 year term in 2020, they again have another election, democratic elections. But at this time the military said that, okay, this election was fraud, and then nullified the election result again and took over on February 1st. So now what it means for a lot of the Burmese people who know what it would mean, because this is not a situation that is that happened the first time. They did the same thing in the 1990 elections after the 88 revolution, when Aung San Suu Kyi entered the election in 1990, and they did the same thing. They nullified the election result and then put her in the house arrest for 20 years, and that continued the military regime for another two decades. So basically as a reflex, people started resisting. The doctors, healthcare workers started this something called the civil disobedience movement. civil disobedience movement, what it is that all the civil servants are saying, walking out of their civil servant jobs and saying, we are not going to work under an illegitimate government because this military, you have no rights to be in politics. You have done so many atrocities in the past decade. We are not going to let you rule anymore. And so a large number of healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, all walk out of their hospital. And especially in the time in a crisis of COVID, the argument is that the doctors already see the suffering of the people, and to top it with the coup, it's just really inhumane for the side of the military to do it. And so they walk out of the public hospital and they say, we'll do our job outside of this traditional formal government bureaucracy. And others, civil servants from other sectors followed through along their leadership. So students stopped going to school, teachers stopped going to work, the people from the banks, people from custom, the whole society just say, we're doing CDM, the civil disobedience, and we are not going to work. And as you see, the civil movement, disobedient movement is so strong at the moment that the military is cracking down and finding anybody in the neighborhood who they know have the knowledge of participating in the civil disobedience movement. So a large number of the people who've been detained at the moment are people who are participating in the civil disobedience movement. They have come out and say, is this civil disobedience movement is a country destroyer movement, and say all atrocious things that this is actually the civil disobedience is even equated to the genocide. So it's like some ridiculous thing that they will come out and say because of how strong this movement is and how threatening this movement is for them. So that is the one piece of the resistance. And then the another piece are street demonstrations. So right after the first week of February, street demonstration and uprising gained momentum in all across cities in Myanmar. So not just in Yangon and Mandalay and Naypyidaw. There are even smaller towns, and for example, in Dawe, people come out to protest every day in large number of, in hundreds and thousands, even when it's raining, even when some people come out to protest in the middle of the night with their candles and do candlelight vigil for people who have died. And all these street demonstrations have also been met with a really cruel, brutal crackdown. So you see the military gunning out on these protesters with gunfire, and in Bagol massacre, in March, we have seen the military use heavy weaponry, hand grenades, and on innocent normal civilian, unarmed civilians. So you see the level of crackdown that that is unseen in any other pro-democracy movement in this recent century. So that's sort of the street uprising, but because of the military has been cracking down so much on the street protests have transformed today into flash mob. So instead of going out and marching on the street, people will come in and protest for about 5-15 minutes and then go back, disperse immediately again. So the guerrilla protests are something that's happening currently at the moment in mass. So, but the resistance hasn't, the momentum of the resistance hasn't slowed down. And obviously there are other parts of banging pots and pans at 8 p.m. at night to drive out the evil that is a military dictatorship. And also there are other bits and pieces. So there are a lot of online movement, creative movement. People are coming out to say humanless strike where they just put random twice or things like that with a lot of the notes. One of the things that I thought was really powerful was something called the cash strike, where people will write revolutionary messages and notes on cash bills. So when people give out money, they are transferring also both the information and messages across to people. So that's also in defiance to the military's information crackdown and control. So these are some of the bits and pieces that has been happening. Obviously, the repression also gained momentum as the movement grows stronger and more threatening. And you also see a lot of armed struggle on the side. And we just recently, in past 2 weeks, we have seen a lot of the youth go into ethnic liberated areas and start training for armed rebellion, basically. And we have seen yesterday, the two of the military air bases were attacked. So the military is actually losing a lot of the footholds in Kachin, Chin, and Karen, because the ethnic groups are also ramping up their armed struggle, in addition with a lot of reinforcement from the youth that are fleeing to their liberated areas. So that's also another piece of the resistance. So it's happening on a lot of the front, and obviously in diaspora as well. The diaspora activists are calling for the international governments to put in a lot more pressure to Myanmar military in terms of sanctions, in terms of diplomatic pressure and all that sort. And one of the main big thing is the current direct action against Chevron, for instance. So Chevron, Total, all of these gas companies are still giving millions of dollars to the Myanmar military at the moment currently. And so there's a lobbying effort to get Myanmar's gas enterprise under sanctions so that the money ties between these large gas corporations and the Myanmar military will stop. So those are the few bits and pieces that are going at the moment. My time is up. So I will just say briefly about what you can do in terms of helping the movement. So there, as I've said before, the civil disobedience movement, it's a really, really strong movement, because it is essentially basically saying that military, you have no right to rule us. You will never be able to rule us. So that's a strong message getting across. And that so long as they don't have control over bureaucracy, their coup will never be successful. But the problem is, because the civil servants are walking out of their jobs, they there needs to be a way to support them, because they're not getting their salaries. So in order to support these thousands of civil disobedience movement workers, we need a lot of money. So there are a lot of places that are raising money for this to give salary to these civil disobedience movement. And some of them are like really low level education, low level teachers and education workers who live by their monthly salary, that because now that it's already been 3 months the movement started, that they are running out of money and they're running out of basic necessities. So it's really important to support them financially. So you can support them and through a lot of donations link, which I will drop in later. And obviously you can also sign in. So in the link that I'm going to drop, there is something called Myanmar Action Toolkit that will explain to you a lot of the things about petition that you can sign, things that you can do to call your representative, and then things you can donate, and resources that you can follow through in terms of getting updated on what is happening in Myanmar. So I'll drop that link and then I'll take the questions.
Okay, Mimi, thank you for that presentation. Now we have 7 minutes for any questions and answers on Burma, Myanmar. If you could take these questions and people, you know, either raise your hands or just speak one.
Okay. Are you able to comment on what was very surprising to me in terms of Aung San Suu Kyi, her comments on the Rohingya genocide?
Yes, so Aung San Suu Kyi basically have a very conservative stance on the Rohingya genocide. And as we all know, she basically defended the military at the ICJ. And why did she do that? Obviously, I'm not clear. I have a lot of speculation and idea on why that might be true. And first of all, the conservative argument, a lot of the NLD supporters would argue, and Aung San Suu Kyi supporter would argue, that at that time, at that place, there was not a lot of things that she could have done. Because if she had stood up for the Rohingya, then the military would have staged the coup then. So that was the argument that they would put, which I don't personally agree, because I think it is one thing to say that yes, the military, it is correct that military had a lot of power over the government, and they have a lot of, I mean, they basically have full control over the country. They're just letting the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi have some power to do, change certain things. Yes, that is true. But at the same time, if you have followed through Aung San Suu Kyi's leadership and her way of leadership and her thinking and her style of leading the movement since the 1988, you know that she is a step-on leader. You know that she's not the person who would have swayed by being scared or being fear of the military trying to do something. She already was at the relationship between her and the general Myanmar line were already sour. So they were not talking at that point already. And I think it was basically her political choice and her personal choice to take that stance at that time. And I think more plausible argument would be that she didn't want to lose support from the Burmese conservative Buddhist, and so she stood up for that. But at the same time, I think she herself is a nationalist leader, and she herself also took a lot of conservative hardline stance on other ethnic minorities as well. And I think that explained a lot more than any of the other, I will say any other arguments, I would say are excuses and not really good arguments in my opinion. And especially because, like, even if the argument say that she was scared of losing support from the Burmese conservative, people just worship her so much that people would listen to anything she would say. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was the fear of losing support. I think it was more of a political choice and personal choice that she made.
Mm-hmm. And consistent.
If I could just add something quickly for context purposes. There's a lot of anti-Muslim and anti-Bangladesh feeling in India towards Bangladeshis that go into India or went into India 100, 200 years ago. And so this is a kind of a regional problem that we see of nationalism in the region. And with climate change and Bangladesh going to get submerged by the ocean, going to have 140, 150 million Bangladeshis or people of Bangladeshi Muslim heritage going into Burma and into India, and the stresses are gonna continue. So I'm not, obviously a Rohingya, a lot of them were there for a long time. So I'm not just saying they're just Bangladeshis, but there is an ongoing regional dynamic that's been going on for a very long time.
And if I understood Mimi's explanation, it was that there were threads of conservative nationalist and potentially anti-ethnic minority viewpoints already evident in Aung San Suu Kyi's politics.
Yes.
So that it was not as contradictory with her history as someone from the outside like myself who doesn't know that history would have thought. Am I correct in that, Mimi?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Do other people have questions? I think I saw David's thumb.
Yes, you did. Thank you. I'm curious to know whether Mimi thinks that the freedom movement in Myanmar is progressing. The military seems very desperate to keep control. Are the people going and gain momentum? If something you can address that.
You got cut off on the second part of the question. So if you can repeat that.
Okay. I wanted to know whether there are more and more people joining the movement in Myanmar, because of the military repression, and it, seems when you look at the media that, you know, that there is a lot more, they're very big demonstrations. And I just wanted to know what's your impression.
So currently the movement is still going on. The momentum is still gaining momentum in the country, but at the same time, you don't see a lot of like large number of crowds on the street as you saw in mid-February or the end of February. And that's because the military, like the moment you go out on the street in a big uprising, the military started shooting down a lot of them. So large uprising, large steady uprising sort of reduced. But at the same time, people are coming out in flesh guerrilla protests. So the number of resistant and the momentum of resistant and the spirit of resistant is continuing and increasing. And I think probably even more so when the military repress. So the more they repress, the more people get angry. And that has keeping the momentum. And a lot of the people are joining, say, armed training. So a lot of the younger people are now also moved to the ethnic liberated area. So that's also another reason you haven't seen a large number of people's protests. But I think it has calmed down a little bit within the past week or so, but now it's getting like starting the 2 days, 2 days before, I think starting this week, you're seeing a large number of people out on the streets again, because the military, after the military crackdown, the military repression has a little bit loosened again, and now you're seeing a large number of people again in the country. And I think, so there's a global action sec for May 2nd. So you will probably see a lot of protests and action this weekend.
Thank you.
I think Pop as a question. You're muted.
Punishment for being polite. How's the mic now?
We hear you.
It's all effectively, it seems to me, pardon my pronunciation, Aung San Suu Kyi. It's almost like she played into the hands of the military, helping to facilitate the coup, you know, by going along with the you know, the Rohingya persecution or genocide, and defending it verbally. And so, you know, everybody who praised her for, you know, winning the Nobel Prize, leaving the resistance and so on, at that point, you know, wanted to abandon her basically and say, well, you know, what was that about? And it's like the ambivalence I think people feel about Navalny, you know, a nationalist, populist, right-winger, wealthy in Russia, you know, a little bit like Boris Yeltsin before him, and so many others in so many other countries, Modi in India, who, you know, really represented, you know, the lower and working classes. So kind of populist, a little bit like Trump in our own country. So I wanted to hear what you had to say about that, Mimi, and I'm hoping that Michael and or Stephen may have something to clarify how to think and respond to situations where you have somebody who, you know, it's a little bit like the Machiavelli's The Prince advice, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Okay, we can work with Aung San Suu Kyi, right? Even though she's got this baggage, or we can support Navalny because he's going after Putin or others. You know, Yeltsin was, you know, better than the Soviet Union, but look what happened. So anyway, and maybe just real quick, those of us who want to say Burma and refuse to call it Myanmar, are we justified? Is there any problem in that?
I think for your first question in terms of Aung San Suu Kyi, yes, Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, play into the hands of military and make that political mistake and at that time. And a lot of people, because of the movement, as the movement evolved, a lot of people are now accepting that. A lot of people know the mistake that she made. And a lot of the people have empathized, began to empathize with ethnic minorities and their struggle, and including the Rohingya. So many people have come out and apologized to our Rohingya community. And now the Rohingya community have a larger say in the movement than if the coup didn't happen. So I think even within the movement, even within the country itself, we have moved on from Aung San Suu Kyi. We have moved on from her leadership and just the leadership of her party, that I think the international community should do the same too. I think it's about time, and she's been in the face of the movement for a long time. There are new faces, there are younger people who are leading this fight. And younger people are calling for more progressive, more inclusive society, and younger people also have more demand that are even larger than the liberation of the Burma itself. We are calling for that there are injustices and man the international order itself, like the United Nations, the order of the current veto of the UN Security Council. We see all of that. And so I think it's sort of about time we move on from just focusing on what Aung San Suu Kyi did. She made this mistake. She was an icon. And then in the first place, it was the internationals who essentially put her on the pedestal in the first place. So I think it's about time we start supporting and seeing these new faces and start moving on to supporting the people rather than focusing on just one icon of a leader or a beacon of hope or whatever you may call it. So I think that's the one thing that I would say. And the second thing is, yes, I think there's a new progressive leadership forming within the National Unity Government itself. Yes, there are still a lot of people who support Aung San Suu Kyi in the country, because I think at the end of the day, you also cannot discredit the fact that she spent about 15 years of her life over the span of 20 years in house arrest for the cause of the democracy that she, the way that she believed in. So that's also stayed in a lot of the people's head. But the younger people are striving for so much more than Aung San Suu Kyi's leadership. The younger people are striving for so much more into an inclusive federal democracy. And I think we have to pay more focused attention on that.
Thank you, Mimi. Okay, we have just barely gone over 1 or 2 minutes on the question and answer section, and we originally had 7 minutes allowed for general discussion on the topic of Burma or Myanmar. So we could have some discussion for a few minutes.
Yes. I'll touch on that. Like, it's also the same topic as well for the younger people who are like us. Like for me, like I don't really care what's Burma or Myanmar. It's, to me, it's potato, potato. Like it's somewhat similar. I'll say a lot of people are still attached onto the name Burma. We just think it should be a new, entirely different name, because it's still confusing Burma and Myanmar, because essentially at the end of the day, it comes from the same word. So I think we should just win the revolution, name ourselves a different name, and that. And then that will solve all of the problems.
Okay. At this point, does anybody have any comments to make to start a short discussion here?
Did Michael have any further things that he wanted to say?
I'll answer questions. Basically, there are lots of stuff I could say, but I'm interested in hearing questions or other comments.
Okay. Is there, in the links that you've provided, Mimi, any indication of who some of the people are we should be watching, or some of the organizations we should be watching?
Yes.
Moving on from Aung San Suu Kyi.
So in terms of moving on from Aung San Suu Kyi, I think the current National Unity Government is something that we should be watching, and what kind of things that they will do moving forward. It's not included in the link because not for the civil society page. But there are also activists that are coming out that are leading the movement, like go to Delta Deza Sam, for instance. But if you go to Freedom Memoirs in the link that I provided in there, those are daily, one-page daily updates that are coming out of Myanmar, and they are very comprehensive and they're really short. So it's really easy to follow. and that's a page to just keep updated.
Thank you very much. Seth?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Mimi, for that really insightful introduction to what's happening. The question I have has to do with tactics. You described a lot of very creative tactics that the Myanmar people are using. And it in particular, I was impressed to learn that, as the protests were being cracked down upon, that they shifted tactics to use the flash mobs, presumably to make them less of a target. And so I'm curious, because the other major threat of tactics you were talking about was the civil disobedience of civil servants and stuff who are not going into their job or doing their jobs outside of the state operations. And it would seem to me that they are also making themselves big targets by taking that action. And I'm wondering if they're suffering repercussions because of that, but maybe don't have an alternative that would be as convenient as the flash mobs were for protesters.
Yes, so the civil disobedience, if you look at it, like the people who are doing civil disobedience are the ones who have been getting cracked down on a lot. And the military basically announced about 20 lists of doctors every day who are involved in CDM movement as a arrest warrant. So there have been thousands of doctors that have been put on this warrant. And they also put on about 20 normal civilians who are famous, who are influential on that another additional 20 people list of arrest warrant who are pushing for civil disobedience or who are helping the civil disobedience in terms of monetary values. So yes, there are a lot of repercussions to an extent that because if you are a government worker, the government probably have your information. So they can't stay at like everybody who's doing civil disobedience cannot stay at their house. So all the people who are doing CDM are now in running or in hiding, staying at a different place, because if they stay at their house, the police come to their house and search them or arrest them. And a lot of that has happened. And a lot of thousands of people has been detained from the civil disobedience movement. So those are like a few repercussions that CDM people have faced. A lot of them, people also know who's the government worker. So night arrest and come in to search. Or sometimes they will come search the CDM strikers house, and if they don't find the CDM striker, they will also arrest the family. So like the entire family has to flee. So there has been people have to create different shelter for these civil disobedience movement participants. So essentially, to an extent, that you're not just giving up your job, you're basically giving up your entire life that you have before, and then moving on and living in a different place and different and running to different houses every day. So that's kind of the situation at the moment. And we have seen, the encouraging part is that we have also seen civil disobedience movement participant from the side of the military. So a lot of the people in military have defected and declared that they are now participating in the CDM. So if we see a large part of that going forward, this is civil disobedience could also be one way that we can finally disband this military as an institution.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mimi. At this point, we are at the place in our agenda where we should change from our general discussion of Burma to a little preview on what's going to happen with these Zoom meetings from now through July. Anybody ready to address that?
Joan, is that something that you could address?
You can kick it back to me if you want
I didn't bring my folder up with me.
All right, it sounds like Mary's got it.
I'll try and pull it out of my hat. What happened? But anyway,
I'm timing for you.
Okay, good. We had some discussions among the weavers about what were we going to be doing in the future from where we were standing at that moment with the Zoom meetings, and wondering whether we would have sort of intensive presentation oriented meetings. We were going to try to do those every month. And I made a suggestion that we didn't necessarily have to do that type of meeting every month, but that sometimes we could have sort of more open discussion meetings without having presenters and so on, which would mean there would be less work for us, the weavers, which people were worried about, because we have effectively kind of lost, I think, a couple of weavers members. One who sort of doesn't seem to ever want to quit, but he sort of keeps moving around out of state or out of the local area. Anyway, and another one what took a leave to deal with personal matters and never reported back in. So anyway.
So the gist is to go every other month, right? Mm-hmm. So we've established a schedule of potential Zoom meetings.
Yes.
That goes Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Yeah.
And then we're going to try. Yes. Okay. Joan, you have something to say?
No, I'm waving goodbye to Mimi because I think she's leaving.
Okay. Bye-bye,
Thank
Mimi.
You, Thank you, Mimi.
Thank you
so much for sharing with us.
Yeah.
Good luck.
But I could just summarize. We, you know, did that survey and most people said less than once a month. Some people said once a month with meetings, and the other people said every other month, and some people said even less. But we ended up scheduling once a month. So whether we actually have it every month or on the off month or whatever, we just have an open thing. Just come and hang out together. You know,
have discussions, but, you know, meaningful discussions, not just, you know.
Oh, okay.
I see.
Not just silly chit chat.
See a hand from Herb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple quick things. Yeah, I was one of the people that suggested every 2 months, concerned as with so many other situations, you know, things kind of peter out. Sometimes less is more. The more often you meet, the fewer people come. We had about 20, I think there were 20 people last time. A great presentation by the several who did that. And of course the topic was elders, how can elders best support young activists? So it was very timely for, you know, all the old M&S people that are still staying in yeah. touch. Similarly, I'm surprised we didn't get more people tonight. I'm very disappointed actually. I thought promotion was fine. Michael, your presentation was fine and your work is, you know, just splendid and so valuable. But long story, yeah, I wish more people had come tonight, and I think every other month will help with that. Absolutely should skip August, because especially late this summer, I guess July and August, people are so desperate to get out and do some things they haven't done for over a year. I think that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now, one more specific, a strong recommendation just hit me tonight. As you know, M&S was founded exactly 50 years ago. I don't know what month. But and we're not going to get together in person for a reunion, but I think a Zoom thing, a big deal could be made out of it to get some of the original founders, you know, half I guess are still alive, you know, to tell stories, you know, and, you know, there's only so much you can do over it. But I would think like a 2 hours of story sharing, and maybe, you know, it doesn't have to bring it up to date or fill in between. It would just be a lot of fun. And I think inspiring to hear that. So that's my recommendation for sometime in the fall, maybe September, after folks are back and settled, and you know, while we still have this 50th anniversary.
Thank you, Herb.
We also had in the survey asking people if they would be willing to lead or you know, present a session, and there were numerous people that did answer that. So we have to look at that and say, okay, what can we schedule around so-and-so, you know, and ask them if they can do it. And then a lot of people listed just things they were interested in, and we haven't collated that yet in the survey. So yeah, that's kind of where it's at. And Mary did have an idea for next month. I don't know what's happening there, if anything.
The idea seems to have flown out of my brain. I don't remember what I said. Well,
I do want to mention that having Stephen Zunis do something that he wanted to do was high on the list of suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
Just hearing from you, Stephen.
Please. Is there some topic you'd like to present on and or lead a discussion on, Stephen?
There could be several. Maybe I can just do a little poll and see which you are most interested in.
Like right now, a poll? Or...
No, I need to think of the list first.
But... Okay, great. Thank you for considering it. Herb?
One quick addendum. I'm kind of inspired. I mean, you know, we have 90 former M&S Life Center folks, 90 in the memorial list. Now, I think almost half of those had died, you know, by our first reunion, some of them in the AIDS epidemic, number. But a lot of folks since then. Alice Mays just turned 90. A number, you know, key founders in their 80s. I really hope we can, you know, celebrate and give them a chance to present a little more about their life, you know, while they're still with us, because we lose a couple every year.
And
that's live. I think that's going to accelerate. And this is our 50th anniversary. So I would make the priority in the fall. And, you know, if we can meet in May or June or both, or May and July, maybe that would, I think May and July probably makes the most sense. And then, you know, September, November, and, you know, skip the holidays.
So May, and then skip June, then have July, and then skip August, and then go do September.
I think that would get us in the every other month, and people will know they can sort of count on that with whatever pattern you say. Mm-hmm. And also I think it would ease the traffic a little bit on the website, and it'll be a bigger deal when it does come around. I'm sorry, did I say website? Yeah, I'm out on the email list.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, while we're talking schedule, we do have a Zoom meeting scheduled for Tuesday, May 25th, for which we don't actually have a topic yet.
Mm-hmm.
Or a presenter. So.
Yeah, but we need to figure that out.
Yeah.
But, you know, pretty quickly, if the Weavers want to hang out for a few minutes after this meeting, we can talk about
it. Okay.
Do West Coast people always want to make it 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern?
Works at my end.
I'm flexible.
Is there a feeling of yours, Herb, about something in the 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern that isn't setting well with you?
No. The only reason I raised it is consideration for the West Coast, because, you know, you're lucky if you get off work by five, a lot of folks.
Hi, this is Nancy Fink. I'm really glad to get together, and I find the meetings with topics really good. I was very glad to have this one about Burma and Myanmar, but meaningful discussions would be fine too. But I was just thinking that, especially for this anniversary that Herb mentioned, if we could all, you know, think about folks we know from M&S who haven't been involved. Like, I know David and I know at least half a dozen M&S people who I don't think have been back at all to any reunion, that we could get in touch with and hopefully bring back into the group for that event. That would be good.
Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah.
Would everyone please raise your hand if you kept registered the contact list, which has, you know, all the contact information we have on 300 former M&S Life Center folks, 300 of them. And there are like 50 or 60, we don't have an email address for, and, you know, we can't contact them. We're not hearing from them. You know, some folks vote with their feet. They don't want to be in touch and they don't want to be involved in anything that we know of. At any rate, but we have 250 with email addresses and 200 on the, it's more than 200 on the email list, but I added a bunch and I haven't heard from some of them, but I will do some follow-up, you know, make sure people want to stay involved or unsubscribe if they don't want to. I'm actually disappointed with the handful of folks that I like, you know, who said, you know, I don't have time for this. It's not a priority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always save your lists, Herb. And yeah.
Are we up to the point where we should evaluate this meeting?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do.
I would like to say to the point Michael brought up and others that I think we expected more people to show up for this one. And while I also respect Herb's point about not overwhelming the M&S whole list, I wonder if there are other ways that we could promote these things or should think about that to make sure that it's on, you know, that people mm-hmm. who might be interested know about it in enough time to put it on their schedules. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to answer that now. I just think that there's a disconnect between mm-hmm. how many people we think will show up on any given one and how many actually do. And I'm not sure how we resolve that.
That includes when we have people RSVP. Yeah.
Mm. Quickest thought to my mind is, you know, with that list, anybody, any of us, each of us, you know, knows on the list who, you know, we'd like to be them to take part or think they would be interested, especially if it's a topic that may concern them, you know, reach out to them individually. I mean, the list is one thing, but it's very easy to ignore anything on the list. And I've been unsubscribing from a lot of them recently, but you know, that individual contact is what makes the difference. You could call them on mm-hmm. the phone, but somebody in your region, you know, you might have a little more excuse, dovetail it with something else. But I think just that personal contact, say, hey, we haven't been touching in a while and I'm fine. These Zoom things have been really helpful. And I think this one next week, you know, would really interest you. I'd love to be on it with you. Here's the link. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do that with some folks.
Yay.
I did invite one guest, but, you know, didn't hear from him. But for this meeting, I really enjoyed Michael's presentation, even though, as you said, it was kind of rushed. But I'm so amazed at what you did with Gene Sharp's, you know, just expanding it. It's wonderful. It's such a good resource that you did that. It was great.
Thank you. I'd like to know. Please read the book. It's short, 110 pages, and you don't have to like read it all through, but I'd welcome a lot of critical feedback and how to improve it and mm-hmm. your thoughts. There are a lot of interesting stuff that I've gathered in the book.
It can be downloaded from the
Yep, free.
Okay.
Free
okay.
download. Mm-hmm.
I love the price and you've already inspired me to sell all my guns.
In terms of moving forward, I don't have the exact idea here, but I do like a mixture of looking back and looking forward. And I don't know what the right balance should be for this group. Obviously, it's a much older group. We don't have a lot of young people and whatnot, so there may be a lot of looking back. There's a lot of shared history. But I do like the idea of not just being a, you know, M&S is an activist group, and it's nice that we at least look forward or look around us contemporarily, and many of us are still active in various ways. So I some sort of balance. I just don't know what it should be.
Well, I agree with you, Michael, and that is the direction that I want to go, which is that balance. I think that we actually have been achieving some degree of that in terms of having been involved with the election protection and
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, Black Lives Matter, those campaigns, the anti-racism work, the Youth and Age Alliance. So I think that we share that value with you and want to continue it.
I've tried to invest other people in joining us as a guest, and people have Zoom fatigue and just don't have the time at the moment.
I think Stephen should, you should consider changing your name to Stephen Zoomus. Seriously, you guys are great. Weavers, thank you so much for all you've done to put this together and coordinate it. And Michael and Stephen, especially on this call, the tremendous volume of work and consistency you've been doing for the decades since we were housemates and troublemakers in West Philly. You guys have gone on, and you know, we don't have to put any of the rest of us down, but you know, you've done tremendous, wonderful work, so valuable to the world, not just the country, the world. So thank you. I hope you can keep that for a very long time, and help spread it this way. And we can forgive you if you have to skip now and then.
Herb, I can even remember your house name / phone number, Pit Plod.
Okay. Well, I think we're at the point of having a closing, unless anybody has other evaluative things they want to add. There we go. Get back to Zoom. Thank you. And we'll be putting out the announcements about what comes next. There is lots of information in the chat, so I encourage you to save the chat to your own computer.
We'll also post that on the website along with the video.
Yeah. So this will be posted, and I encourage folks to...
Seth, I hope I can get it by Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah, we'll get it by tomorrow.
Great. And so we announced this as something that would be recorded. And I think that the reach can be increased by our sharing the video with people we think might be interested.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for coming.
Good job, Fred.
Hasta la vista. Thank you all.
There's David on me. It says Nancy.
Yeah. Sorry, it's me. It's Nancy.
Sounds like Nancy.
I can't get rid of that picture. I don't know why. Okay. Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, y'all. Is there anything else we want to discuss as weavers right at this moment?
I think we should decide what we're going to do in May, because it's only a month away. We can't wait for 2 weeks. And right. Mary, let me just remind you, you had originally projected the possibility of having a session on class issues with Betsy.
All right. I'm going to get on the stick with that, because what I'm doing for therapeutic inactivity is sitting at my computer desk for many hours. And so I could do that while I'm sitting here, not having my knee freeze because I'm not standing on it, you know, standing on my feet.
One comment I want to make is, first of all, I want to thank you, Fred, for putting this together and for, you know, working with Michael. Yeah. Something up and stuff like that. And one kind of evaluative comment that occurs to me as well, I didn't say before, was that both of these topics could have been sessions in their own right. To talk about the whole tactics thing and how Jim Sharp did his and what Michael's done and what he's thinking about and all that kind of stuff, that's a big topic in its own right. And Myanmar, of course, or Burma, is a big topic. And it felt like there wasn't really enough time to talk about either. And so not that we can do anything about that now, but it feels to me like if we have a topic in the future, someone wants to talk about something, we ought to think about in those terms as well. You know, is that a topic that would generate enough discussion and you know, a little bit of white space for people to have time to think about it and you know, have that discussion. We didn't really have any discussion per se. We had a little Q&A. You know, we had people ask questions and Mimi in particular responded to it, but we didn't get the interaction among all these intelligent, passionate compatriots that we have who could bounce off each other and really kind of create something, some synergy there. And there wasn't enough space for that. I think, you know, what you did with the agenda was fine given what we intended to cover. And I think that your ability to, you know, roll with the punches when some things went over was great given the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But I think it might have been ambitious to begin with. Now
I agree with you about that. The way in which I was thinking about it originally was that Michael was able to give a pretty concise presentation on what he had done with the book and the tactics website. And the fact that he and George